So last week I brought up this doubt that arises often in our conversation and in other Dharma conversations that I have and with peers and students and community around the place of social action and engagement for those of us also cultivating a contemplative or meditative or Dharma path. For some folks, this is really obvious that a kind of engaged Buddhist path is natural and feels right, unquestioned. For others, there can be a lot of doubt around, you know, how to balance the different inclinations and passions we might have, you know, for social justice and for inner peace of various kinds. Are those opposed to each other? And I think this is particularly troubling sometimes to folks who relate primarily to the early Buddhist teachings. Many of the later traditions, the Zen and Tantric traditions, and Pure Land traditions very much, have much more built into their theology structures for thinking about service for others and altruistic action in service of reducing suffering in the material world and the here and now as being important. The early Buddhist system doesn't contain as much of that overtly or explicitly. And so, you know, in my insight meditation community, which is descended from the Theravada and early Buddhist system, there really can arise this doubt, and we've swirled with it for, you know, many years in this community around the place and the rightness of social action. And so last week we talked a bit about that doubt as we're in, you know, a very chaotic, tumultuous moment in American political life, and by extension, global political life, because of how central this country is to the global well-being, for good and for ill. So I wanted to reflect on that a little bit more tonight, and be a little bit more prescriptive rather than descriptive. Last week, I kind of just sketched out the existence of the doubt and offered, you know, a framework for how we might be with the doubt and figure this out for ourselves. And so tonight I'm going to do something a little bit different from that. And I'm just going to encourage you to be socially active straight up for a reason. And the reason essentially is that we are lay people. And so in thinking about this problem this week and, you know, thinking about it very much in real time as I'm watching the news and I'm watching the, you know, what Rebecca Solnit is calling the stupid coup unfold. And, you know, crisis after crisis and you know, kind of so much that seems to ask for a public, strong public response. And I'm feeling myself supporting, participating, and I have been participating. I've given to, you know, special election campaigns and I'm participating in layers of the, like, how do we help stop the worst of what's happening right now in the political field in this country. Even as I'm doing that and tracking what's happening, being with this feeling of, like, how does this relate to liberation practice, to Dharma practice? And the thing that kept coming forward for me was around my role as a lay person. So lay person here is means not a monastic, not a monk or a nun, not an ordained person who's living within a structured life model based in renunciation. So I'm going to tease out a bit the difference between lay people and monastics and how it might relate to social engagement. When we read the Buddhist texts, very, very often we are reading teachings given by the Buddha or his senior disciples to monastics and sometimes to lay people. And it's always distinguished in the beginning of the text who it's being given to. So sometimes this or that lay person, of this or that social class comes to the Buddha and asks a question and he interacts with them. Sometimes it's, ordained people from other traditions, other lineages, other ascetic groups that come and engage with him in debate. But very often it's him teaching his own community, the monks and nuns. And very often when we as teachers in the insight meditation world speak about discourses given to the monastic community, we say very little about the monastic context. So, the text that is the cornerstone text of the mindfulness movement, the Satipatthana Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya 10, or Digha Nikaya 22. The text begins, bhikkhus, so ordained, monastics. Bhikkhus, this is the way to the purification of the heart, et cetera, and freedom. Namely the foundations of mindfulness or the four Satipatthana, here's what they are. And then it goes into this, marvelous, rich, detailed explanation of meditation and somatic inquiry leading to profound freedom. This text is the cornerstone text of the insight meditation movement, which is a lay movement, right? Started in the 60s and 70s, has transplanted into what became or has become, insight meditation in Europe and America and now globally. And insight meditation as a tradition is almost entirely non-monastic. So it starts as a monastic meditation focus. It starts with monastics teaching meditation to lay people. So it's not like lay people are stealing this from monastics, right? It's purposeful that it was taught to lay people. And it's very much the case that monastics do this as well. They teach, the same techniques to lay people as they do to monastics when it comes to meditation. And it's generally true that lay people can do a lot of the same meditation type practices that monastics can do. Often it's more difficult for lay people because we're not doing them 5 hours a day, or however many. It's also more difficult because of the amount of stuff filling our minds and attention based on our social roles. And this is important, right? So the meditation techniques can be taught to both monastics and lay people. And lay people, under the right conditions, can accomplish much of what monastics can accomplish, right? Can certainly accomplish deep levels of freedom, of concentration, of meditative immersion and insight, totally possible for lay people. So this is not saying that these two different ways of practicing are different in that way. But we also do something when we ignore the difference between monastics and lay people and just assume that everything offered to monastics, especially meditationally, like we ignore the Vinaya, the monastic rules. That one's clearly delineated for monastics. But within the suttas, we assume that, the kinds of instructions offered to monastics, like the foundations of meditation, like emptiness, like the insight into selflessness, that these are, just as much our material as they are the monastic's material. But this may not be the case. And so what's really different about monastics and lay people? They can do more or less the same meditations. Monastics have the same kinds of bodies as we have. It takes the same kinds of things to keep a body alive and well and healthy. All of that is more or less the same. So what's different? Mostly, I want to focus on two core differences between the monastic life and the lay life. The monastic life in, and I'm talking really from the renunciate Theravada style. So some like Zen and Tantric, Mahayana and Tantric traditions changed this. So they created monks who use money, monks who have sex and families, you know, monks who are other than their job as being monks or priests, you know, otherwise indistinguishable from lay people with really cool costumes or whatever. I'm not talking about them, but monks who are observing the Vinaya are different from lay people in two fundamental ways. One is that they don't use money. And so they neither earn money nor spend it themselves as individuals. They don't touch it. So they separate intentionally from the entire realm of commerce, right? From wealth gathering, working for income, spending money, choosing things to buy, all of that social class that comes from wealth and money. And the other huge thing that they set down is sexuality, which feels like the biggest deal, right? Celibacy. But I think that what it really points to is what they're setting down is family, right? So they're not creating families, they're not having children, and they're not being in sexual relationships, romantic relationships, which also really means like dyadic or maybe poly even, but like emotional relationships, right? Monastics live in a communal friend relationship that's hierarchical by seniority and otherwise is peer structured. And so friendship becomes the center of social life for monastics rather than a romantic or sexual connection as for lay people. And so monastics have set down two ways that we interact with the world around us. One is commercial and one is relational. So what are the impacts of this, right? How much of your life as a layperson is involved with those two things? Your intimate relationship life, whether you're partnered or not, but all of the ways that your friendship life, your community life revolves around the flux of intimate relationship. The people around you in intimate relationships, your flow of intimate relationships, your partnership or non-partnership, your desire for partnership or not, all of those elements that really revolve around, you know, how am I structuring my life in the world? Who's with me? Who's with me and close with me for this, for the duration of this, you know, project in this body? How much of what we do is immersed in that? And then how much of what we do is immersed in the earning and spending of money? Everything about possessions, like owning things at all. This is a thing connected with commerce that monastics don't do, is they don't own anything, right? They have essentially on long-term loan, a bowl, you know, a spoon, a razor for shaving the head, right? A couple pairs of robes, some shoes. It's all pretty come and go. You know, they take care of their things very, very carefully. They only have a few things and they don't really think of them as owned. And that's it. Everything else belongs to the monastery. It's all on loan. It's all gifted from lay people, ultimately belongs to the lay people. So how much of our life is wrapped up in acquiring, tending, preserving things and the wealth that makes things possible? And so between commerce and relationship, you know, that's a huge, huge percentage of our life. And so our immersion in those realms and the monastic's renunciation of those realms is the primary difference between these two lifestyles. And so when we think about social action, what are we thinking about? You know, often conversations around engagement in Buddhism get abstract and heady very quickly. They start to turn on, you know, whether engaging with the world is somehow at odds with the project of liberating oneself from it in some way, right? It gets very, very philosophical, soteriological oriented toward freedom very quickly. But if we keep it very material, if we keep it on the, you know, on the material resources level, we're partly talking about how we spend our time. So what do you do in the course of a day? What do you have time to do? What do you do with your day? But also, what realms of life are we engaging in? And in a way, the framework that I want us to reflect on is that social action, so participating in civic culture, right, beyond like my immediate friend community, but really participating in the life of my town or, you know, region or watershed or state or nation, you know, or global, you know, situation somehow, that doing this is fundamentally economic and relational. And that's why it is not difficult to find ourselves to feel the rightness of social action, even as contemplatives, as lay contemplatives, but also that it's an appropriate field for lay contemplative action or for lay person action at all. If we can feel that we really are lay people, that this is our proper domain, right? That, and I think part of why this can be confusing for some Western lay people, lay Buddhist practitioners, is that the lay meditation movement, which is a 20th century phenomenon, the lay meditation movement has created a very interesting kind of alternative social class, right? It's very small, it's super fringe, but I've been part of it, and many of you have or are as well. It's folks who have renunciate leanings, so who are not particularly interested in making a lot of money or whipping up a big complicated relational life, who want to keep things really simple, who really love contemplative practice, who spend a lot of time in contemplative practice, and who in a sense are drawn to a monastic kind of life, a relatively renunciate life, without actually becoming formal monastics. And I think if, you know, if there was a strong extant monastic tradition in this culture, I probably would be one, because it would have been present throughout my childhood and teenage and early adult years, when I was so disaffected and turned off by mainstream culture that all I wanted was to renounce it. If these very nice people had been on the corner, you know, of my town with a nice temple where I could just move in, I'm sure I would have done it, you know, but it wasn't available. It wasn't here, right? This is not a monastic oriented culture. I had to work hard to find it. And by the time I found it, I was much further into adulthood and much more established in forms of life that, you know, amplified the lay lifestyle. But there's this middle ground that many of us can or have inhabited, where it's quite renunciate, but not actually monastic. And I think it's these people who particularly can feel the ache or the doubt around social action. Like, I'm really drawn to letting go, letting go, letting go, you know, settling into a deep peace inside. But I have doubts about whether that's appropriate, whether it's even moral or ethically appropriate to do so. I think it's partly because I haven't formally taken monastic vows, but also because it's not actually materially possible to do so. You know, I used to, before I was married, I was living in San Francisco. I was mostly working as a dancer and a musician, and I was a piano teacher. I would cater really hard between November, between like Thanksgiving and New Year's, and then, you know, earn as much money as I could. And that was the fastest way I knew to earn money without commitment. And then I would go on long retreat. I would do the 2-month retreat at Spirit Rock, and you know, or I went to Asia, or I did more long retreat. I was basically like, I just want to be on retreat as much as possible. And I'm only coming back to the city to work just long enough to make enough money to go back on retreat. And of course that, you know, that wasn't sustainable because I wasn't a monastic. I wasn't actually living in a Dana based world, right? It's not easy to maintain a life like that. And so we're torn. And in that tornness, there can be a real ambivalence around participating in cultural structures like politics that are so obviously, in many ways, distasteful, right? They're corrupt, they are unpleasant, they're full of all sorts of unpleasantness. And they are how the system works, right? They are how we make change, they are how goodness is protected, they are how people are protected. And so I want to propose then that that in the same way that work is difficult, but it makes good things possible for lay people, and that relationships are difficult, but make good things possible, that social action, that political action is difficult and, sometimes inspiring and sometimes unpleasant, but that it is part of the weave of lay life in a way that's not optional. In the same way that making enough money to support yourself and your family is not optional, that even to hide out and pretend that you're not engaged in politics at all, and this is not most of you, but maybe this is you secretly, that to not vote is to vote in a certain way, right? You know how that works, right? To not engage in the democratic process when your voice matters is itself an action. And so not being formal renunciates protected by the system of Dana and the monastic lifestyle, which I think we should understand as not just like slightly different from lay life, but actually dramatically different from lay life. And that it's a real and radical and kind of extraordinary thing to do, to cast yourself upon the protection of the larger community in that way, and to really let go, of participating in the commercial and relational world in that way. To live very differently, very radically communally, that has its own whole tone and landscape of culture, and that when we're not in that, where it's not appropriate to pretend that we are, right? That it's and if you're in your retreat junkie phase and you're like, no, that's totally me. I just work barely as much as possible to go on retreat more. Blessings to you. I have no critique of that lifestyle. I did it for years. But, and honestly, some days I wish I was still doing it, right? But just to understand that even when we are in a period of lots of retreat like that, if we're still lay people, we are still, bound in the role of the lay person, right? We are participating in the culture around us, in the communities around us. We are noticed, we matter in that way. And so, I'm encouraging us really to resolve any doubt that we might be holding around how social action, activism, political action is appropriate or not for the dedicated Dharma practitioner, by understanding that our role as lay people makes it appropriate and even vital to do so. That it's as vital as participating in wise livelihood. I think it's actually an extension of the limb of wise livelihood in the Eightfold Path to do so. And that it's really our responsibility to perform our role fully to the extent that we're able, and that doesn't demand of you a certain kind of political action. Some people are protesting people, some people are, you could be any number of kinds of action, the thing that I think this is asking is that we don't succumb to the idea that our delight in contemplative practice is an appropriate reason to turn away from participation in the culture around us. All right, so pausing there. It feels good to say, I think I never said it that vigorously before, even to myself. So I'm curious how this lands for you all and how it resonates. And in this moment when you know the shit is really hitting the fan over here in North America, you know, that this is a moment to not let any old ideas we have about what we should or should not do as folks connected to spirit get in the way of a kind of urgency that I think many of us feel to protect what is good in a moment of dramatic harm. All right, thank you so much. Hi, thanks for joining us for this talk and practice. If these recordings are helpful for you, please consider supporting the Sangha with a donation of any amount. You can find links to our website and the donation page below in the description. Liking and subscribing helps the channel, and I'm grateful for your presence, your practice, and anything you can give to support our little community. Thank you so much. Take care.